Widows. Just jumping straight in there. Widows, not a subject you might expect that we would spend a Sunday evening looking at. There may be a minority here who, because of your own personal circumstances, have great interest in this subject. But if you're not in that category, let me try and keep your attention this evening by saying that actually, the passage that we've just read is not really about widows per se, but it's actually about two other things. First, church economics. We'll talk about what that means in a moment. But second, family relationships. The widow's part is just the specific application of 1 Timothy's teaching on those two subjects, church economics and family relationships. So let's discover more as I set the scene. If you've been with us these last few weeks, you'll know that in our walk through 1 Timothy, the first of what we call the three pastoral epistles, Paul the Apostle has been writing, hasn't he, to instruct Timothy, the young church leader, in supervising the affairs of the Ephesian church and perhaps other churches in what is today Western Turkey. Paul has dealt with proper teaching in chapter 1, proper worship in chapter 2, proper church leadership in chapters 3 and 4. And now he turns to proper relationships in chapter 5. So proper relationships with those older and also younger than Timothy, verse 1 and 2 of chapter 5. Proper honor for church elders, verse 17 to 25. But in between, our focus today, proper support for widows in the church, verse 3 to 16. Now, a bit more context might help here. In the Greco-Roman world, when a husband died, all of his property and assets, they passed to his children, not to his wife. As you can see, a bit different to UK inheritance law. If there was a dowry paid at the marriage by the wife's father, a husband's death would mean that the dowry would pass either to the new head of the household, which was always a male, so either the firstborn son or back to the wife's father, who was then supposed to look after the widow. Of course, no government assistance here, no government assistance for widows in the Roman Empire, no family court to enforce child support. That would be from the child to the mother. So I wonder if you can imagine, if a widow has no children and if her father had died, she was totally dependent on other people's charity. And some, it was thought, had to turn to prostitution. Today in the UK, around 500 women become widows every day. And now, as in Ephesus, statistically, it's far more likely that women will be widowed than men, and it's far less likely for women to remarry than men. However, I think it's safe to say that even with our proposed tax credit cuts coming up in the UK, our inheritance and social security system, compared to that in Ephesus, leaves widows reasonably supported. So maybe the two systems are not exactly comparable. However, in contrast, in Ephesus, a widow is likely to be amongst the poorest in society, and certainly the most vulnerable in society. Now, in this passage, some scholars argue that Paul has two distinct types of widow in mind: the destitute who need help, verse 3 to 8, and those who belong to a special order of widows, verse 9 to 15, like an order of nuns where a stipend is given for carrying out certain duties in the church. Now, personally, I'm not so sure about an order of widows in Ephesus.
Whilst 300 years later, there's actually indisputable evidence that such a thing as an order of widows existed. I tend to side from the context with those scholars who see verse 3 to 16 as general instructions to all widows. One group, not two, with no special widow's order in mind. What seems to be the issue here in Ephesus is that there are just simply too many widows looking to the church for charity. That's the issue. So this whole passage is Paul's attempt to sort out a defined criteria. Literally, verse 9, an enrollment list. An enrollment list of widows as to those widows who are eligible to receive financial support from the church and those who are not. Now, I wonder what you make of that. Perhaps you're thinking, but surely the church, then and now, we should be indiscriminate. Surely we should help everybody. Surely this, from Paul, it is more business strategy than it is spiritual care. Well, have a look with me at verse 3. Give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. And again, verse 5. The widow who is really in need and left all alone puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. And the last part of verse 16. So that the church can help those widows really in need. I wonder if you get a sense of the principle here. God, through Paul the Apostle, wants us as a church to be involved in supporting the needy, the truly needy in our church. This passage is about deciding how you define who those truly needy are. And Paul wants Timothy here to discriminate, yes, discriminate between those who on one hand were in genuine need of provision, even happy to give something back to serve the church, verse 9 and 10. And on the other hand, those who didn't really need the church's help, verse 6 and verse 11 to 15. Those who were just in it for the freebies, actually. They weren't being very productive in the church community. Verse 9 and 10 actually say that only those who have been faithful and are known for good deeds and are sufficiently old that they probably won't want to marry again should be provided for. To be a widow of 60 in Paul's time was considered the age at which one became officially elderly. I can see a few of you smiling at that. Few men made it past 60. Today, how do we regard somebody who's 60? Middle-aged, with the pension age creeping up. Some of us here may think that 60 is actually quite young. But eligible widows had to be 60 plus. But the sort of widow who was eligible to receive financial support was also one who had a track record of godliness. Have a look with me at verse 9 and verse 10. Faithfulness in her marriage, bringing up probably other people's children, maybe orphans, being the go-to bed and breakfast for visiting Ephesus speakers, even feet washing, that's a catch-all phrase meaning the humility to perform humble acts of service. Eligible widows also helped those in trouble, which probably refers to what we think of as pastoral care. Home visiting, being an instrument of God's care, God's comfort. Well, what a list that is. Who ticks all the boxes? Who has already been doing all these things in order to qualify for being on the widow's list? Either there were so many widows in Ephesus that the criterion had to raise the bar exceptionally high, or Paul wanted the enrollment list to consist of just two or three names, perhaps. Or maybe more likely, there were a lot of godly widows in Ephesus, some of whom Paul had in mind as he wrote this.
That's the eligible widows, but there's also the ineligible, the younger widows.
That's right, Paul is ageist. He's using positive discrimination in verses 11 to 15.
Younger widows are not to be put on the list because, he says, by virtue of being younger, they're more likely to remarry. Now, nothing wrong with that, of course. If you look back at verse 14 and what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, it's obvious Paul doesn't have a problem with anybody remarrying. But perhaps here he either means going on the widow's list means taking a vow not to remarry, or he's referring to marrying outside the faith. This is, of course, remarriage once your husband has died. In either case, Paul doesn't want to put these women in a position of making a vow, I won't marry, so therefore I'll need the church's support, and then later breaking it, marrying, and so not needing the church's support. But more than just being too young, apparently the false teachers in Ephesus we've been touching on in the last few weeks were also making inroads through some of these younger widows. Can you imagine these young women going from house to house, nothing better to do, and instead of ministering, they're idling and they're gossiping and they're busybodies. Consequently, Paul says, some of these younger widows had already abandoned their faith in Jesus. They turned away to follow Satan, verse 15. That's what Paul means by not giving the enemy an opportunity for slander. Can you imagine how these widows' actions were scandalizing the church in the eyes of the community? Think of the sneers. Look at how lazy those Christian widows are. Look at how gullible the church is for keeping them in support. So, verse 14, Paul wants these younger widows to remarry and reestablish a family. He's not trying to be insensitive to the grief of losing their husbands, but he's looking long term. He's thinking strategically. Now put yourself in Timothy's sandals. He has to go to these younger widows and he has to tell them that the church isn't going to support them anymore. Sometimes church leadership involves saying no to people. And yet he has to do it with respect, verse 2, treating these younger widows, older than himself, as if they were his mum. So let's zoom back up and look at the principle again. We're talking here about what do we do if in our church there's limited resources and infinite wants. We have to discriminate. We have to come up with criteria to decide how we use our resources. A cursory glance through our annual church financial statements will assure you that, yes, we do have limited resources. And a cursory glance out of the window will assure us that, yes, there are infinite ways in which we can spend our money and our time as a church. The economists amongst you will have noticed that this is, of course, the basic economic problem. How do we allocate limited resources amongst infinite needs? Well, priority should go to those who are truly in need. Those who cannot provide for themselves, and not those who are just around for the free handouts and don't give anything back. But the principle is, as a church, we have to make choices. We have to discriminate who we support and how we support them. Not often you go to a church and you hear someone saying that the Bible encourages discrimination, but in this specific instance, that's exactly what is needed. And that's why it's good that we at
Cambrai have such a thing as a mission partner process, for instance, that Simon Rouse and team have worked so hard to produce for us. We have a proper process for those we support financially from this church. There's criterion, there's a document, there is biblical precedence for this kind of thing. But the principle does not just apply to finances. We at Cambrai, like Ephesus, we have limited cash, yes, but we also have limited space. We have limited numbers of volunteers. We cannot do everything we want to do as a church. We cannot help everyone. We cannot give equal time and equal attention and channel equal resources to everyone in Cheltenham. And so we need a plan. We need a strategy, a vision that starts with the question, what exactly is it that God wants us to do here in Cheltenham? Who is it that we're trying to reach? And who are we therefore, by implication, not trying to reach? If we're putting our resources in one area, we're not putting our resources into another area. Or in an economist's language, what is the opportunity cost of doing this thing? What can't we do if we do this thing? Too often we maybe refuse to make choices and we spread ourselves too thin, maybe. We try and do everything and we lose intentionality, as we heard last Sunday evening. We lose intentionality with what we are doing, and in the end we end up reaching very few. But instead we do need a strategy, as we saw in our video earlier. What is the best way to organize our resources to make the greatest impact for the gospel? Is it missional communities? Something we need to consider, perhaps. Henry Ford once said, "I take the church's survival as proof of God's existence. No other enterprise that runs so poorly could stay in business." What is the strategy? But we can also think about this principle personally. Have a think to yourself. Since my resources, my time, my money are limited, who should I prioritize? In this church, who is in genuine need that this week I can help? Extending the principle a bit further, it might mean that when we give to charities or to individuals, making sure that we're giving to those in real need rather than indiscriminately giving to everyone and anyone. It may affect who we give to on the street. We need to use discernment and discrimination in the way we support the needy. So that's the first of Paul's principles, God's principles through Paul. You might be wondering from the passage, but okay, fine. What about the rest? What about the other widows, the younger ones? What if you're 59 years old? Are they just passed by in the church's welfare system? Well, Paul knows that the large majority of the problem is solved if we, as the church, adhere to one other principle that we've already touched on at the beginning. The second principle is not just a Christian principle. Actually, it's a universal principle. And it is this: care for family. Care for family, which inevitably requires sacrifice. Have a read with me of verse 4. "But if a widow has children or grandchildren, they should learn first of all to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family and so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God." And again, verse 8, "If anyone does not provide for his relatives and especially for his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." And finally, verse 16, "If any woman who is a believer has widows in her family, She should help them and not let the church be burdened with them, so that the church can help those widows who are really in need.
Now, if a widow has Christian children or grandchildren, they should put their Christian faith into practice by caring for their mother or their grandmother's needs sacrificially. Paul clearly has the fifth commandment in the back of his mind: honour your father and mother. I wonder what you thought when you read verse 8. It's a strong warning, isn't it? It warns us quite strongly that Christians who refuse to care for their aging family members are in danger of falling away from the faith. Inaction betrays an abandonment of the fifth commandment. So when Paul claims that this person is worse than an unbeliever, he means that the non-Christians in Greco-Roman society had higher morals than this Christian, since even non-Christians kept this obligation to their family to help elderly parents. So the principle which releases the burden on the church, is for individuals to care for aging family members who cannot care for themselves. I know of several people here who've done exactly that as an expression of your faith in Jesus. Some of you have taken an aging parent into your home. Others have sacrificed financially. Some of you have had to pull back from your involvement in other ministry to do family ministry. This text doesn't tell us exactly how to care for family, but I suspect that how we do this will be unique in every circumstance. But the majority of us, at some point in our lives, are going to have to prepare for providing for our parents in some way, if we don't do so already. If you are a student here, or were recently a student, those days, if you can remember back to them, were the first time in your life that the income and the support of parents finally stopped coming in your direction, and the beginning of the table slowly turning until you are actually providing for them financially, emotionally. And doing so is a biblical command. I must say that with Mick talking about Kenya earlier and African culture and Asian culture, there's streets ahead of us than us in the West on this one. They're streets ahead. A lot of my Melody's friends from China, in their 20s, are already giving their parents 30% of all their income. That's quite standard in China. Not always because of the Bible, sometimes because of Confucianism and Chinese culture generally. But each of us is called to care for our own family. Now, I'm aware that there's a lot of yes, but what ifs in all this. But from the Bible, honouring our father and our mother, honouring your wider family, and especially your parents, is God's will for your life. Even if relationships can be strained at the best of times, even if they may not yet be Christians. You may say, but what if my parents want me to drop my career or even my marriage to look after them? Well, clearly your first priority is to your spouse, but you have to judge how to juggle career and family commitments. What if I give my parents money and they don't spend it wisely? Well, I suppose they probably thought the same thing about you at some point. You can provide for needs, I can provide for needs in ways other than financial. What if one or both of my parents don't want my help? Well, maybe they might not need or want our money, true, but they will always need our support, they will always need our love, they will always need our care. However you apply this to your life, and it is a personal thing between you and the Lord, caring for family will require sacrifices, sometimes large sacrifices.
A good friend of mine whom I spoke with on the phone this week, he decided that in order to look after his terminally ill sister, he'd live with her, he'd look after her, and in his life he wouldn't marry at all. And he's been doing that for many years, and he's now in his 70s. Sacrifice. Care for family is important. It is a biblical command. How is God calling you to care for family, whether that's wider family, siblings, parents, grandparents? Making time to visit more often, supporting financially, it's between you and the Lord. But God, through Paul, is saying here to Timothy, and by extension to us, to care adequately for our own elderly family members is to repay our parents. It is to please God, verse 4. It is to express and not deny our faith, verse 8. And it is to relieve the church, verse 16. Well, as we come into land, let's consider again what God might be saying to us this evening through these two principles. First, support the truly needy and the discriminating choices that involves. But second, care for your family and the sacrificial choices that involves. Who is God putting on your heart personally to support and to care for? How is God calling us as a church to be strategic in the way we organise our use of resources? And how is God asking us to relate to members of our family that we are called, that we know we're called to care for? Many questions, many angles. Let's just have a longish pause to consider some of these things before the band come up and we sing again.